Side 7, The Mark of the Assassin by Daniel Silva. Continuing on page 317. He could have killed you, Delaroche said, but he didn't because you behaved perfectly. You stalled. You told him nothing. You were never alone. I was right behind you the entire time. If he wanted to kill me, you couldn't have stopped him. This work is not without risk. You know that. Stoltenberg's words ran through her head. He's very sloppy, this Frenchman of yours. He sent you into a very dangerous situation. I'm not sure I can go on, Jean-Paul. You took the assignment. You took the money. You can't back out now. I want to go back to Amsterdam, to the Prinsengracht. That door is closed to you now. She took inventory of her injuries once more. Split lip, bruised cheekbone, a mark like a handprint on her right breast. She had never been in a situation where she was helpless, and she didn't like it. I don't want to die like an animal in the desert. Nor do I, he said. I won't let that happen to either of us. Where will you go when this business is finished? Back to Brele, if I can. If not, the Caribbean. And where will I go, now that the door to Amsterdam has been closed to me? He put down his guns and lay on top of her. You can come with me to the Caribbean. And what will I do there? Whatever you like, or nothing at all. And what will I be to you? Will I be your wife? Delaroche shook his head. No, you will not be my wife. Will there be other women? He shook his head again. No, there will be no other women. I'll be whatever you want me to be, but you mustn't humiliate me with other women. I would never humiliate you, Astrid. He kissed her mouth gently, so as not to hurt the cut on her lip. He unbuttoned her galabeah and kissed her breasts and the ugly mark left by Stoltenberg's hand. He slid down her body and pushed up the galabeah. The terror she had felt hours earlier melted with the exquisite sensation of what he was doing between her thighs. Where will we live? She asked softly. By the sea, he said, and resumed. Will you do this to me by the sea, Jean-Paul? She felt his head nod between her legs. Will you do this to me often by the sea, Jean-Paul? But it was a silly question, and he did not answer it. She took his head and pulled him tightly against her body. She wanted to tell him she loved him, but she knew such things would never be said aloud. Afterward, he lay next to her, softly breathing. Do you sleep at night, Jean-Paul? Some nights are better than others. Do you see them? I see them for a while, and then they go away. Why do you kill them that way? Why do you shoot them in the face 3 times? Because I want them to know I exist. Her eyes closed, and she drifted toward sleep. Are you the beast, Jean-Paul? What are you talking about? The beast, she repeated. The devil. Perhaps you leave your mark on their faces because you're the beast. The people I kill are wicked men. If I don't kill them, someone else will. It's just business, nothing more. It's more than business with you, Jean-Paul. It's... She hesitated, and for a moment he thought she was finally asleep. It's art, Jean-Paul. Your killing is like art. Go to sleep, Astrid. Wait for me to fall asleep before you do, Jean-Paul. I'll wait, he said. She was quiet for another moment. Then she said, When you retire, what will become of Arbatov? I suppose he'll have to retire too, Delaroche said. He's an old man anyway. Are you the devil, Jean-Paul? Astrid said, but she was asleep before he could answer. She dug it from her bag in the moments before dawn. The little item from Le Monde about a retired Russian diplomat killed by street thugs in Paris. Delaroche was sleeping, or pretending to sleep. She was never sure. She carried the clipping to Fahmy's treacherous balcony and read it once more in the beige dawn. Perhaps it wasn't Jean-Paul, she thought. Perhaps it really was just a robbery. Cairo stirred beneath her. Azabeline entered the alley, a little girl dressed in rags, sleepily flicking an ass with a switch. The muezzin screamed. A thousand more joined in. She touched a match to the clipping and held it aloft until flame engulfed it. Then she released it and watched it drift downward until it came to rest on a pile of garbage and turned to gray ash. Chapter 31, Cairo. The taxi ride from the airport had taken nearly as long as the flight from Rome. It was hot even for November, and there was no air conditioning in the well-worn little Fiat. Michael sat back and tried to relax. He knew getting agitated would only make matters worse. Cairo was like a trick knot that became tighter the more you struggled. The driver assumed Michael was a rich Egyptian back from a Roman holiday, and he prattled on about how bad things had become. He had the modest robe and unkempt beard of a devout Muslim. The road was choked with every conceivable type of transport. Cars, buses, and trucks belching diesel fumes, donkey carts, bicycles, and pedestrians. A wispy boy shoved a live chicken in Michael's face and asked if he wanted to buy it. The driver shouted him away. A colossal image of the Egyptian president smiled down benevolently from a roadside billboard. He wouldn't be smiling if he were stuck in this traffic with the rest of us, the driver murmured. Michael had never lived in Cairo, but he had spent a great deal of time there. He had served as the control officer for an important agent inside the Mukhabarat, the all-pervasive Egyptian security service. The agent didn't want to be debriefed by an officer from Cairo station. He knew the embassy and the CIA residents were well monitored. So Michael slipped into Egypt from time to time, posing as a businessman, and did the debriefing himself. The agent provided valuable intelligence on the state of radical Islam in Egypt, the most important U.S. ally in the Arab world. Sometimes the information flowed the other way. When Michael learned of a plot to assassinate the Egyptian interior minister, he passed the information to this agent. The plot was foiled, and several members of the Al-Gama at Ismailia were arrested. Michael's man received a big promotion that gave him access to better intelligence. The Nile Hilton is located on Tahrir Square, overlooking the river. Tahrir means liberation in Arabic, and Michael always thought it was the most inappropriately named place on earth. The immense square was jammed with traffic well into the night. The taxi hadn't moved an inch in 5 minutes. The blare of traffic horns was unbearable. Michael paid the fare and walked the rest of the way. He checked into the room, showered and changed, and went out again. The Mukhabarat had one of the most extensive monitoring operations on earth. Michael knew his room telephone was certainly bugged, even though he was traveling as an Italian businessman in town for a round of meetings. He went into the Tahrir Square metro station and found a telephone kiosk. He spoke quietly into the receiver for 2 minutes, raising his voice once to shout over the clatter of a train entering the station. He had 2 hours to kill. He would put the time to good use. He boarded the next train, got off at the first station, and doubled back. He walked. He went to the Egyptian Museum. He was lured into a tourist shop that specialized in fragrant oils. The shop boys plied him with tea and cigarettes while he sampled several oils. Michael rewarded their hospitality by purchasing a small bottle of vile sandalwood oil, which he tossed in the nearest rubbish bin as soon as he left. He was clean. No surveillance. He flagged down a taxi and climbed inside. Cairo is a city of lost elegance. Once there were fine cinemas and an opera house and walled villas that spilled chamber music into the warm nights. Little is left, and what remains has the quality of newspaper left too long in the sun. Many of the villas have been deserted. The opera house is gone, and the theaters stink of urine. The restaurant Arabesque has the feel of old Cairo, rather like an old man who putters around the house all day dressed in a suit and tie. It was mid-afternoon, the quiet time between lunch and dinner, and the dining room was nearly deserted. Michael actually had to strain to hear the din of traffic noise, so thorough was the restaurant's insulation. Yusuf Hafez was seated at a corner table far from anyone else. He looked up and smiled as Michael approached, flashing two rows of perfect white teeth. He had the look of an Egyptian film star, the fleshy type in his 50s with thick graying hair who attracts younger women and beats up younger men. Michael knew it was not far from the truth. They ordered cold white wine. Hafez was a Muslim, but he thought strict adherence to Islamic law was for the crazies and the peasants. They clinked glasses and talked about old times for an hour, while the waiters brought plate after plate of Lebanese-style appetizers. Michael finally got around to business. He told Hafez he was in Cairo on a personal matter. He hoped Hafez would help him out of friendship and professional courtesy. Under no circumstances could he discuss this matter with his current control officer. He would be paid for his help directly from Michael's pocket. "You can buy me lunch and another bottle of this wine, but keep your money." Michael signaled the white-jacketed waiter to bring more wine. While the waiter poured, Hafez talked about a pizza he had eaten in Cannes that summer. The Mukhabarat employed tens of thousands of informants. It was always possible the waiter was one of them. When he was gone, Hafez said, "Now, what can I do for you, my friend?" "I want to talk to a man named Eric Stoltenberg. He's former Stasi, living in Cairo doing freelance work."
"I know who he is."
"You know where to find him?"
"Actually, I do."
Hafez set down his wine glass and signaled for the check. The body was in a warm room with 100 others, covered in a gray sheet. The attendant's coverall was spotted with blood. Hafez knelt next to the body and looked to Michael to make certain he was ready. Michael nodded, and Hafez drew back the sheet. Michael looked quickly away and retched once, the lunch at Arabesque rising in his throat.
"Where did you find him?" Michael asked.
"Near the pyramids on the edge of the desert."
"Let me guess.
Shot 3 times in the face."
"Exactly," Hafez said, lighting a cigarette to cover the smell.
"He was last seen in a nightclub in Zamalek, a place called Breakpoint."
"I know it," Michael said.
"He was dancing with a European woman. Tall, blonde, German maybe. Her name is Astrid Fogel. She used to be a member of the Red Army faction."
"She did this?"
"No, I suspect she had some help. You have videotapes of all arriving passengers at Cairo Airport?" Hafez pulled a face that showed he found the question mildly amusing.
"Mind if I have a look?"
Hafez covered the body and said, "Let's go." They placed Michael in a room with a videotape deck and monitor. A pair of fat totems moved silently in and out, bringing new tapes in one direction, taking the old ones in the other. They brought him tea, Russian style, in a glass with an ornate metal holder. They brought him Egyptian tobacco when his Marlboros were gone. He worked backward, beginning 24 hours before the murder. October would be meticulous. October would plan it carefully. He found her sometime after midnight. She was tall and erect, and her hair was drawn back tightly, accentuating her long nose. Her large hands seemed to struggle with the passport as she handed it across to the customs officer. October appeared 5 minutes later, short, light on his feet, like a fencer. The brim of a baseball cap, pulled low over his brow, obscured much of the face, but Michael could see enough of it.
He froze the two images and called for Hafiz.
"Here are your killers," Michael said, when Hafiz came into the room. "This one is Astrid Vogel, the German woman whom Stoltenberg was dancing with at the nightclub." Hafiz pointed at the second image.
"And that one?"
Michael stared at the screen.
"I wish to Christ I knew."
Chapter 32, Amsterdam. It was a bitterly cold dawn when de la Roche and Astrid returned to the houseboat on the Prinsengracht. For 20 minutes, de la Roche inspected the vessel carefully to make certain no one had been aboard. He checked his telltales. He tore through the cabinets in the galley and the drawers in Astrid's bedroom. He prowled the frozen deck. Astrid was no help to him. Content to finally be aboard her beloved Krista, she collapsed fully clothed on the bed and watched him with one eye as if he were mad.
De la Roche felt alert and refreshed, despite the long journey. The previous morning they had flown from Cairo to Madrid, having first explained to Mr. Fahmy that they were cutting short their stay at the Hotel Imperial because Madame was very ill. Fahmy feared it was the toilet that had driven them away. He offered the hotel's best suite to entice them to remain, but de la Roche assured him it was the water, not the toilet, that had forced them to leave. From Madrid, they had taken the train to Amsterdam. De la Roche spent the journey hunched over his laptop like a businessman, planning his next assassination. Astrid slept fitfully next to him, reliving the last. The canal had frozen again, and once more the Krista was filled with the joyous shouts of skaters. Astrid took sleeping pills and covered her head with a pillow. De la Roche was too wired to sleep, so at mid-morning, when the sun burned away the clouds, he went onto the foredeck and painted, bundled in a heavy sweater and fingerless gloves. The light was good, and so was the subject matter. Skaters on the canal, gabled houses in the background. And when it was done, he thought it was the best work he had produced in Amsterdam. He had a curious desire for Astrid's approval, but when he went below and tried to wake her, she just mumbled that her name was Eva Tebbe, and she was a graphic artist from Berlin, and to please stop slapping her. He left her in the early afternoon, pedaling her bicycle through Amsterdam with his laptop computer slung over his back. He locked the bike outside a telephone center near the Rijksmuseum and went inside. He entered a booth, hooked up his computer, and worked the keys for a few moments. He had one piece of electronic mail. He opened the mail, and it came onto the screen as gibberish. He entered his code name, and the message appeared in clear text. "Congratulations on the successful completion of your mission in Cairo. Payment has been wired into your numbered account. We have one additional assignment for you. If you accept, you will be paid $1.5 million, half in advance. To accept, press the enter key. Payment will automatically be forwarded to your account, and a dossier and operational details will be downloaded onto your computer. The file will be encrypted, of course, and your code name will unlock it. If you wish to decline, press escape." De la Roche looked away from the screen and thought for a moment. With that fee, he would have an extraordinary amount of money, more than enough to guarantee comfort and security the rest of his life. He knew it was not without risk, though. The assassinations would grow more difficult. Erich Stoltenberg was proof of that. And now he was being asked to carry out another killing. He wondered, too, whether Astrid could go on. The confrontation in Cairo with Stoltenberg had taken a heavy toll on her. De la Roche realized, however, that Astrid's life was now tied inexorably to his. She would do what he wanted her to do. He pushed the enter key. The file downloaded onto his laptop over the high-speed modem. He glanced at the dossier and shut down the computer. He knew the man. He had confronted him once before. He put away the computer and dialed his bank in Zurich. Herr Becker came on the line. "Yes, Two deposits had been made to the account. One for $1 million, a second for 750,000 moments ago. Delaroche instructed Becker to wire the money to the Bahamian accounts. He left the telephone center and went out to collect Astrid's bicycle. A thief was working the lock. Delaroche politely informed him that the bicycle was his. The thief told Delaroche to fuck off. Delaroche drove a foot into his kidney. As he rode off in the bicycle, the thief still lay on the ground, writhing silently. Astrid slept until after sunset. They had coffee in a cafe near the Krista and walked the canals until dinner. Astrid inhaled the cold, clear air of Amsterdam, trying to cleanse her lungs of the dust and smoke of Cairo. Her nerves were brittle from sleeping pills and coffee. A man with gray blonde hair bumped into her. Astrid was reaching inside her bag for her gun before Delaroche put a hand on her arm and whispered that it was nothing, just a stranger in a hurry. They ate like spent lovers in the restaurant on the Herrengracht, where Delaroche had taken her the first night. She had eaten nothing in Cairo, so she devoured her own food and most of Delaroche's. Her complexion, bone white with exhaustion and nerves, took on color with the food and the wine and the night air. He told her over dessert. Her face registered nothing more than mild annoyance, as if Delaroche had informed her he would be working late at the office that evening. "You don't have to do it," he said. "I don't want to be without you." They made love beneath Krista's skylight to the screams of skaters on the Prinzengracht. Afterward, Delaroche confessed he had shot down the airliner off New York, along with a Palestinian boy whom he had killed. He told her he believed the men they had killed were involved in the attack as well, or that they somehow knew the truth. "Who are the men that hired you?" she asked, touching his lips. "I honestly don't know." "You must know they will kill you, Jean-Paul. When you finish the contract, they'll come after you. And me, too."
"I'm aware of that."
"Where will we go?"
"To our house on the beach."
"Will it be safe there?"
"It will be as safe as anywhere else." She lit a cigarette and blew a slender stream of smoke at the skylight.
He reached for his laptop, turned on the power, and punched a few keys. The hard drive whirred. Then the image of a dark-haired man appeared on the screen. "Why does this man have to die?"
"I suspect he knows too much." Another image appeared. Elizabeth Osborne.
"His wife is beautiful."
"Yes."
"A pity."
"Yes," Delaroche said, and he closed the laptop.
Chapter 33, Shelter Island, New York. Michael made the last ferry of the night. For a few moments, he stood at the rail in the cold air, but the wind and sea spray drove him back inside the rented Buick from JFK. He had called Adrian Carter from the Long Island Expressway and told him he was back in the country. Carter wanted to know where the hell he had been. Michael said he would come to headquarters tomorrow afternoon and explain everything. When Carter demanded an explanation now, Michael lied and said the cellular connection was bad and hung up. The last thing he heard was Adrian Carter uncharacteristically screaming obscenities as he replaced the phone in its cradle. Rollers broke over the prow, dousing the windshield. Michael flicked the wipers. The lights of Cannon Point burned across Shelter Island Sound. The images of the last weeks played out in his mind. Flight 002, Colin Yardley, Heathrow, Gorzhdov, Muhammad Awad, Eric Stoltenberg, Astrid Fogel, October. They were like pieces of a melody he could not complete. He was certain the Sword of Gaza had not carried out the attack. He believed it was the work of another group, or individual, which did it in the name of the Sword of Gaza. But who? And why? October was a contract killer only. If he were involved, It would be at the behest of others. The same was true of Astrid Fogel. The Red Army faction had neither the resources nor the motive for staging the attack. Michael suspected he knew the truth, or at least part of it. The man called October had been hired to eliminate the team that carried out the attack. The ferry docked at Shelter Island. Michael turned over the engine and drove off. Shelter Island Heights was deserted, shops and Victorian cottages dark. He sped along Winthrop Road, through a tunnel of leafless trees, and skirted the edge of Daring Harbor. In the summer, the harbor was filled with sailboats. Now it was deserted except for the Athena, bobbing at her mooring in the Whitecaps off Cannon Point. Michael also suspected he had been the target on the Channel Ferry, not Muhammad Awad. Who was the man beneath the balaclava? Was it October? He had seen October use his gun in person on the Chelsea Embankment and on videotape, and it didn't appear to be the same man. He had to assume he was still a target, and he had to consider the possibility they now would send October, one of the world's best assassins, to do the job. He would have to tell Carter and Monica Tyler everything. He needed their protection. He would tell Elizabeth everything, too, but for very different reasons. He loved her more than anything else, and he desperately wanted to regain her trust. Cannon Point appeared before him. Michael stopped at the security gate, lowered his window, and entered the code. The gate rolled open, and lights came on in the caretaker's cottage. Michael drove slowly up the long gravel drive. A clan of white-tailed deer, snacking on the dead grass of Cannon's broad lawn, looked up and eyed Michael warily. He saw a shaft of light and heard dogs barking. It was only Charlie, the caretaker, walking toward him, retrievers yapping at his heels. Michael shut down the engine and got out. Lights came on in the main house, and the door swung open. He saw Elizabeth framed in the light, shrouded in one of the senator's old coats. She stepped outside, watching him, arms folded beneath her breasts. Wind blew hair across her face. Then she came to him in a few careful steps and hurled herself against his body. "Don't ever leave me again, Michael."
"I won't," he said.
"God, I'm so sorry. I want to talk. I want you to tell me everything."
"I'll tell you everything, Elizabeth. There are things you need to know." They talked for hours. Elizabeth sat on the bed, knees beneath her chin, fidgeting with an unlit Benson and Hedges. Michael roamed and paced, now sitting at her side, now staring out the window at the waters of the Sound. True to his word, he told her everything. He felt the tension release with the unburdening of each secret. He wished he had never kept things from her in the first place. He always told himself it was for Elizabeth's protection, but he realized now that was only part of the truth. He had lived a life of secrets and lies so long, he knew no other way. Secrecy was like a disease, an affliction. His father had caught it, and it had driven his mother mad. Michael should have avoided the same mistakes. She was silent for a long time after he finished. Finally, she said, "What do you want from me?" "Forgiveness," he said.
"Forgiveness and understanding." "You have that, Michael." She put the unlit cigarette back in the pack. "What's going to happen tomorrow at Langley?" "They're probably going to put a loaded .45 in front of me." "What are you talking about?" "I'm going to be in serious trouble. I may not survive it." "Don't toy with me, Michael. There isn't a lot of work out there for disgraced spooks. We don't need the money. You can take some time off and do something normal for the rest of your life." She saw the impact of her words on his face and said, "God, Michael, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. There's just one thing I want to do before I go. I want to know what really happened to that jetliner. I want the truth." "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set ye free, eh, Michael?" "Something like that." Is she gone?
Is who gone?
Sarah. Is she gone?
She was never there to begin with.
That's clever, Michael. But answer my question. Sometimes I'll think about what happened to her. But I don't love her, Elizabeth. And I don't wish she were lying there instead of you.
A tear rolled down her face.
She punched it away and said, "Come here, Michael. Come to bed."
She lay in his arms for a long time, crying.
He held her until the shaking stopped. She looked up at him, face damp, and said, "Mind if I tell you a little about my day now, darling?"
"I'd love to hear about your day."
"Four of the eggs fertilized. They implanted them this morning. I'm supposed to take it easy for a couple of days. They'll do a pregnancy test and see if it worked."
He laid the palm of his hand on her stomach. She kissed his mouth.
"Michael Osborne, that's the first time I've seen you smile in weeks. It's the first good news I've had in weeks."
She trailed a finger through his hair.
"Will they come for you?"
"I don't know. If I'm out, I'm no threat to them anymore."
"Will you quit tomorrow? For me?"
"I don't think I'm going to be given a choice."
"And the truth shall set ye free," she said.
"Amen."
Chapter 34. Cyprus. The small Gulfstream jet sat on the isolated runway, engines whining in the darkness. The pilot was named Roger Stevens, a former officer of the Royal Navy's Fleet Air Arm, who was decorated in the Falklands War. He now worked for the transport section of the Society. As he mechanically went through the pre-flight checks, Stevens was missing one crucial piece of information, a flight plan. The passengers, a man and a woman, were supposed to supply that on boarding. He assumed it would be a long flight, though. He had been ordered to take on a full complement of fuel. 30 minutes later, a black Range Rover turned onto the runway and headed toward the Gulf Stream at high speed, headlights dark. It stopped at the foot of the stairway, deposited two people, and sped quickly away. Stevens had flown several missions for the Society, for which he was well compensated, and he knew the rules. He was not to look at the faces of the passengers, nor was he to speak to them. The arrangement suited Stevens fine. The Society and the men they employed were a rough lot, and he wanted as little to do with them as possible. The passengers boarded the plane and took their seats. A black nylon duffel bag had been left on board for them, and the refrigerator was well stocked with food and wine. Stevens heard the rip of a zipper, the metallic crack of an experienced gunman checking the action of an automatic weapon, the pop of a champagne cork, the murmur of a woman speaking German-accented French. A moment later, the man entered the cockpit and stood behind Stevens. "The flight plan," he said simply. The language was English, with a vague accent Stevens could not quite place. The flight plan was thrust before his face, along with a silenced Beretta handgun. Stevens took the flight plan. Delaroche said, "Stay in the cockpit and don't look at either one of us. If you look at us, I'll kill you and land the plane myself. Do you hear me?" Stevens nodded. A chill ran down the back of his neck. Delaroche left the cockpit and took his seat in the passenger compartment. Stevens reached back without turning around and closed the cockpit door. A moment later, the engines fired and the Gulf Stream lifted into the Mediterranean night. Chapter 35. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia. Michael always thought environmentalists would have a field day with Monica Tyler's office. Perched on the 7th floor, it was large and airy and overlooked the trees along the river. Monica had scoffed at the idea of decorating her lair with government furniture and had brought her own from her New York office instead. A large mahogany desk, mahogany file cabinets, mahogany bookshelves, and a mahogany conference table surrounded by cozy leather chairs. Trinkets of ivory and silver were scattered about, and fine Persian rugs covered much of the ugly gray-blue government carpeting. One wall was dedicated entirely to photographs of Monica with famous people. Monica with James Beckwith. Monica with director Ronald Clark. Monica with a famous actor. Monica with Princess Diana. In the notoriously camera-shy world of intelligence, Monica was a veritable cover girl. Entering the room, Michael smelled coffee brewing, a rich, dark Italian or French roast. And from somewhere, he could hear quiet orchestral music. Adrian Carter arrived next, looking very hungover. He sniffed at the air, smelled the coffee, and frowned. Monica arrived last, 5 minutes late as usual, followed by Tweedledee and Tweedledum, each clutching a leather folder. They sat at the conference table, Monica at the head, the factotums at her right hand, Michael and Carter at her left. A secretary brought a tray of coffee and cream and a plate of dainty cookies. Monica gaveled the proceedings to order by tapping the tip of her stiletto gold pen on the polished surface of the table. "Where's McManus?" Carter asked. "He had to go downtown to the Hoover Building on an urgent matter," Monica said tonelessly. "Don't you think the FBI's representative to the Counterterrorism Center should be sitting in on this meeting?" "Anything the FBI is required to know will be passed on to them in due course," she said. "This is an agency matter, and will be dealt with as such." Carter, unable to hide his anger, gnawed on the nail of his forefinger. Monica looked at Michael. "After the incident on the ferry, you were ordered to return from London immediately and report to headquarters. You disobeyed that order and went to Cairo instead. Why?" "I believed I could uncover valuable information concerning an active investigation," Michael said. "I didn't go because I wanted to see the pyramids." "Don't be a smartass. You're in enough trouble as it is. What did you learn in Cairo?" Michael placed the photographs given to him by Mohammed Awad on the table and turned them so Monica could see. "Here's Hassan Mahmoud, the man found dead in the whaler, meeting with a man named Eric Stoltenberg in Cairo a few weeks before the attack on the jetliner. Stoltenberg is former Stasi. He worked in the department that supported national liberation and guerrilla groups around the world. He's freelance now. Mohammed Awad, before he was shot on the ferry, said Mahmoud had joined forces with Stoltenberg." "Two men having coffee in a Cairo cafe is hardly proof of a conspiracy, Michael." Michael held his temper. Somewhere during her ascent to the top, Monica had mastered the art of derailing her opponent in mid-thought with a barb or a shallow contradiction. "I went to Cairo because I wanted to talk to Stoltenberg." "Why didn't you pass on the information to Carter at the center and let someone from Cairo station handle it?" "Because I wanted to handle it myself." "At least that's honest," continued. "By the time I got to Cairo, Stoltenberg was dead." Michael dropped a photograph of Stoltenberg's ruined face on the table. Carter looked away and winced. Monica's face remained placid. "He was shot 3 times in the face, just like Hassan Mahmoud, just like Colin Yardley, and just like Sarah Randolph." Michael looked down at his hands, then at Monica. "Yes," he said, "just like Sarah Randolph." "And you believe these killings are all the work of the same man?" "I'm certain of it. He's a former KGB assassin, codenamed October, who was inserted into the West as a young man and planted deep. He's a contract killer now, the world's most expensive and proficient assassin." "And this you learned from Ivan Drozdov?" "That's correct." "Your theory, Michael?" "That Mohammed Awad was telling the truth. The Sword of Gaza did not carry out this attack. It was the work of some other group or individual, done in the name of the Sword of Gaza. And now October has been hired by this group or individual to liquidate the team that carried out the attack." Michael paused for a moment, then said, "And eventually he will come after me." Would you like to explain that? I think they tried to kill me once already, on the ferry during the meeting with Awad. They failed. I think they'll try again, and this time I think they'll give the job to October. There was a long pause. Conversations with Monica were always punctuated by moments of silence, as though she were receiving her next lines from a stage prompter in the wings. Who's they, Michael? What they? Where they? How they? I don't know. Someone blew up that jetliner and did it for a very good reason. Look what's happened in the interim. The Mideast peace process has collapsed. Arms are pouring into the region like never before. Michael thought. And a wounded president came from behind and won re-election, and this country is about to build a costly missile defense system. Good God, Michael. Surely you're not suggesting any kind of linkage. I don't know all the answers. What I'm suggesting is that we seriously consider the possibility other forces were involved in the attack and broaden our investigation accordingly. Adrian Carter finally spoke. I thought Michael was off the mark when he raised this with me the first time, but now I believe I was mistaken. I think the agency should do as Michael suggests. Monica hesitated a moment. I reluctantly concur, Michael, but I'm afraid the investigation will go forward without your involvement. She treated herself to a long sip of her coffee. You have uncovered potentially valuable intelligence. But your means and methods have been inexcusable and, frankly, unbefitting an intelligence officer of your experience. I'm afraid I have no choice but to place you on suspension, pending the outcome of a disciplinary review. I'm sorry, Michael, but you've left me no other option. Michael said nothing. He had expected it, but still a shock wave shot through him when Monica spoke the words. As for your concerns about your personal safety, you can be certain that the agency will take every step necessary to protect you and your family. Thank you, Monica, Michael said, and immediately regretted it. Assurances from Monica Tyler had the permanence of a sonnet written on the surface of a lake. The chauffeured car bearing Mitchell Elliott arrived at his townhouse on California Street shortly after 8 p.m. It had been a very long day. Much of it spent on Capitol Hill twisting arms. Elliot had been around politics long enough to realize euphoria has a tendency to wear off rather quickly in Washington. Promises made by presidents often die the death of 1,000 cuts in committee. It would be many months before the National Missile Defense came before Congress for a vote. The tragedy of Flight 002 would be a distant memory by then, and Beckwith would be a lame duck president. It would be left to Elliot to make sure the program didn't fall by the wayside. He had spread millions of dollars around Capitol Hill. Half the members of Congress were indebted to him. Still, he realized it was going to take every ounce of his influence and imagination to see the project through to the end. The car stopped at the curb. Mark Callahan got out and opened the door. Elliot went inside the house and walked upstairs to the library. He poured himself a glass of scotch and went into the bedroom. The bathroom door opened, and a woman entered the room, dressed in a terry cloth robe, hair damp from the shower. He looked up. "Hello, Monica, darling. Tell me about your day." "He underestimates me," she said, lying next to him in bed. "He plays me for the idiot. He thinks he's smarter than me. And I detest people who think they're smarter than me." "Let him underestimate you," Elliot said. "It's a fatal mistake, in this case, literally." "I had to reopen the investigation today. I had no other choice." "Osborne has managed to uncover quite a lot of your little game." "He's only scratched the surface, Monica. You know that as well as I do. And besides, there's no way he'll ever see the whole picture. Osborne is trapped in a house of mirrors. He knows the identity of your assassins, and he thinks he knows why they're killing. He doesn't know who's behind them, and there's no way he ever will." "I had to put out a worldwide alert for them, Mitchell. Who controls the distribution at Langley?
Everything comes to me eyes only, she said. Theoretically, no one else in the building will see it. And I sent McManus out on an errand, so the Bureau is completely in the dark.
And Michael Osborne will never know what hit him.
Good girl, Monica. You just earned yourself a nice bonus.
I had something else in mind, actually.
December. Chapter 36, Northern Canada. The Gulf Stream dropped below radar cover over the Davis Strait and landed on a remote flare-lit road along the eastern shores of Hudson Bay. Astrid and Delaroche ambled down the stairway, Delaroche with a nylon duffel slung across his back, Astrid with her hands over her face against the cruel Arctic air. Stevens never shut down the engines. As soon as Astrid and Delaroche were clear of the aircraft, he raced down the road once more, and the Gulf Stream lifted into the clear Canadian morning. A black Range Rover waited for them on the shoulder of the road, filled with cold-weather outdoor gear, snowshoes, backpacks, parkas, and dehydrated foods, and a packet of detailed travel instructions. They climbed in and closed the doors against the bitter air. Delaroche turned the key. The engine groaned, struggled, then died. Delaroche felt his heart sink. The jet was gone. They were completely alone. If the truck didn't start, they could not survive long. He turned the key once more, and this time the engine started. Astrid, typically German for an instant, said, "Thanks, God."
"I thought you were a good communist atheist," Delaroche cracked.
"Shut up and turn the heat on." He did as she asked. Then he opened the packet and tried to read the instructions, but it was no good. He removed a pair of half-moon reading glasses from the breast pocket of his coat and thrust them onto his face.
"I've never seen you wear those before, Jean-Paul."
"I don't like to wear them in front of people, but sometimes it can't be helped."
"You look like a professor instead of a professional killer."
"That's the point, my love."
"How do you kill people so well if you can't see?"
"Because I'm shooting them, not reading them. If there were words written across their foreheads, I'd need my glasses."
"Please, Jean-Paul, drive the bloody car. I'm freezing to death."
"I have to know where I'm going before I drive."
"Do you always read the instructions first?"
He looked at her quizzically, as if he found the question mildly offensive.
"Of course you do. That's why you're so bloody good at everything you do. Jean-Paul Delaroche, methodical man."
"We all have our vices," he said, putting away the instructions. "I don't ridicule yours." He dropped the Range Rover into gear.
"Where are we going?" Astrid asked.
"A place called Vermont."
"Is it near our beach?"
"Not quite."
"Shit," she said, closing her eyes.
"Wake me when we're there."
Chapter 37, Washington, D.C. The first day of Michael's exile was appalling. At dawn, when the alarm awakened him, he rushed into the shower and turned on the water before realizing he had nowhere to go. He went downstairs to the kitchen, made toast and coffee for Elizabeth, and brought it up to her. She had breakfast in bed and read the Post. A half hour later, Elizabeth was letting herself out the front door, dressed for work with her two briefcases and two cell phones. Michael stood in the front window, waving like an idiot, as she drove off in her silver Mercedes. All he needed was a cardigan and a pipe to complete the picture. He finished the newspaper. He tried to read a book, but couldn't concentrate on the pages. He tried to put the time to good use by checking all the door locks and replacing batteries in the alarm system. That took a total of 20 minutes. Maria, the Peruvian housekeeper, came at 10 o'clock and chased him from room to room with her industrial-strength vacuum and toxic furniture polish.
"It is a beautiful day outside, Señor Miguel," she said, shouting at him in Spanish over the roar of the vacuum.
Maria spoke to him only in her native language. You should go out and do something instead of sitting around the house all day. Michael understood his own housekeeper had just dismissed him. He went upstairs, dressed in a nylon warm-up suit and running shoes, and went back downstairs. Maria thrust a piece of paper into his hand, a list of cleaning supplies she needed from the store. He stuck the list in his pocket and went out the front door onto N Street. It was a warm day for early December, the kind of afternoon that always made Michael think there was no neighborhood in the world more beautiful than Georgetown. The sky was clear, the air breezy and soft, and scented with wood smoke. N Street lay beneath a blanket of red and yellow autumn leaves. They crunched beneath Michael's feet as he jogged lightly along the red brick sidewalk. Reflexively, he looked through the windows of the parked cars to see if anyone was sitting inside. A van bearing the name of a Virginia kitchen supply store was parked on the corner. Michael committed the name and number to memory. He would call later to make certain the place was real. He ran down the hill to M Street and crossed Key Bridge. Wind gusted high on the bridge and made rippled patterns on the surface of the river below. It was like two different rivers. To Michael's right, a wild river stretched northward into the distance. To his left lay the waterfront of Washington, the Harbor Place complex, the Watergate, the Kennedy Center beyond. Reaching the Virginia side of the river, he looked over his shoulder for any sign of surveillance. A thinly built man in a Georgetown baseball hat was 100 yards behind him. Michael put his head down and ran faster. Past Roosevelt Island, through the grass along the George Washington Parkway. He climbed up onto the Memorial Bridge and looked over his shoulder down the parkway. The man with the Georgetown cap was still there. Michael stopped and stretched, looking down from the bridge at the footpath below. The hatted man continued running south along the river toward National Airport. Michael stood up and resumed running. During the next 20 minutes, he saw 6 men with caps and 3 men he thought might be October. He was jittery, he knew. He ran hard the rest of the way back to Georgetown. He stopped in Bowie Monger's, a sandwich shop popular with students from the university, and ordered a coffee to go. He sipped it as he walked along N Street and let himself into the house. He showered and changed and went out. He telephoned Elizabeth at the office from his car. I'm going to Langley, he said. I have a little housekeeping I need to take care of. There were a few seconds of silence on the line, and Michael said, Don't worry, Elizabeth. I wouldn't miss this afternoon for anything in the world. Thank you, Michael. See you in a couple of hours. Michael crossed Key Bridge once more and turned onto the George Washington Parkway. He had made this drive thousands of times before, but now, as he headed to Langley to clean out his desk, he saw it all as if for the first time. There were giant poplars, tributaries leaking from the rocky hills of Virginia, sheer bluffs overlooking the Potomac. At the front entrance, the guard punched in Michael's identification, frowned, and told him to pass. Michael felt like a leper as he walked through the harshly lit corridors toward the CTC. No one said a word to him. No one looked in his direction. Intelligence services are nothing if not highly organized cliques. When one member contracts a disease, the others stay away, lest they catch it too. The bullpen was quiet as Michael stepped through the door and walked to his desk. For an hour, he picked through the contents of his drawers, separating the personal from the official. A week earlier, he had been feted because of his actions at Heathrow. Now he felt like the kicker who had just missed a game-winning field goal. Every once in a while, someone would come forward, lay a hand on his shoulder, and move quickly away. But no one spoke to him. As he was leaving, Adrian Carter poked his head into the bullpen and gestured for Michael to come into his office. He handed Michael a gift-wrapped box. I thought it was only a suspension pending an inquiry, Michael said, accepting the package. It is, but I wanted to give you this anyway, Carter said. His drooping eyes made him look more morose than ever.
Open it at home, though. Some people around here might not understand the humor.
Michael shook his hand.
Thanks for everything, Adrian. See you around.
Yeah, Carter said.
And Michael, take care of yourself.
Michael walked outside and found his car in the parking lot. He tossed Carter's gift in the trunk, climbed inside, and drove off. Passing through the gates, he wondered if he would ever be back again. Michael met Elizabeth at the Georgetown University Medical Center. He left the Jaguar with a valet and took the elevator to the doctor's office. When he walked into the waiting room, there was no sign of Elizabeth. For an instant, he had the sinking feeling that he had missed the appointment. But a moment later, she walked through the door, clutching her briefcases, and kissed him on the cheek. A nurse showed them to the examination room and left a gown on the table. Elizabeth unbuttoned her blouse and skirt. She looked up and noticed Michael staring at her.
Close your eyes.
Actually, I was thinking about locking the door.
Animal.
Thank you. Elizabeth finished undressing, slipped into the gown, and sat down on the examination table. Michael was fooling with the knobs of the sonogram machine.
Would you knock that off?
Sorry, just a little nervous. The doctor came into the room. He reminded Michael of Carter. Sleepy, disheveled, a look of perpetual boredom on his face. He wrinkled his face as he read Elizabeth's chart, as though torn between the mahi-mahi and the grilled salmon.
The beta count looks very good, he said.
In fact, it's a little high. Why don't we have a look with the sonogram? He raised Elizabeth's gown and covered her abdomen with a lubricating jelly. Then he pressed the wand of the sonogram against her skin and began moving it back and forth.
There it is, he said, smiling for the first time. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a very nice-looking egg sac.
Elizabeth was beaming. She reached out for Michael and grasped his hand tightly. The doctor manipulated the wand for another moment.
And here is a second very nice-looking egg sac.
Michael said, Oh, God. The doctor shut down the machine.
Get dressed and meet me in my office. We need to talk about a few things. And, by the way, congratulations.
At least we won't need to buy a bigger house, Michael said, trailing Elizabeth upstairs to the bedroom.
I always thought a six-bedroom Georgetown Federal was too big for just the two of us.
Michael, stop talking like that. I'm 40 years old. I'm beyond high risk. A lot of things could go wrong.
She lay down on the bed.
I'm starving.
Michael lay beside her. I can't get the image of you covered with lubricant out of my mind.
She kissed him. Go away. You heard the doctor. I need to stay off my feet and rest for a few days. I'm at my most vulnerable right now.
He kissed her again.
I won't argue with that.
Go downstairs and make me a sandwich.
He climbed off the bed and went down to the kitchen. He made Elizabeth a sandwich of turkey and Swiss cheese and poured her a glass of orange juice. He placed the sandwich and drink on a tray and carried it upstairs to her.
I think I could get used to this.
She took a bite of the sandwich.
How was it at work today?
I've obviously been declared an untouchable.
That bad?
Worse.
Who gave you that?
She asked, gesturing at the gift-wrapped box.
Carter.
Aren't you going to open it?
I thought I could live without another set of cross pens.
Gimme, she said, tearing at the wrapping while she chewed an enormous bite of the sandwich.
Beneath the wrapping paper was a rectangular box, and inside the box was a sheet of documents stamped Most Secret.
Elizabeth said, Michael, I think you need to take a look at this.
She thrust it at Michael, and he flipped through the pages quickly.
What is it?
He looked up at her.
It's the CIA case file on a KGB assassin codenamed October. Chapter 38, The U.S.-Canadian Border. Delaroche waited for the first light. He had found a secluded spot in the woods, well off the highway south of Montreal, about 3 miles from the border. Astrid slept next to him in the back of the Range Rover, beneath a heavy woolen blanket, body hunched against the cold. She had begged Delaroche to run the heater from time to time, but he refused because he wanted silence. He touched her hands as she slept. They were like ice. At 6:30 he rose, poured coffee from a thermos flask, and made a large bowl of oatmeal. Astrid came out 10 minutes later, swaddled in a down parka and fleece hat. "Give me some of that coffee, Jean-Paul," she said, taking the oatmeal and finishing the rest. Delaroche placed their supplies into a pair of small backpacks. He gave the lighter one to Astrid and shouldered the other himself. He placed a Beretta in the front waistband of his trousers. He quickly went through the vehicle from end to end to make certain they had left nothing that might identify them. The Range Rover would be left behind. Another was supposed to be waiting on the American side of the border. They walked for an hour through the mountain ridges above Lake Champlain. They could have made the crossing by staying to the frozen lake shore, but Delaroche deemed it too exposed. 2 pairs of snowshoes had been left in the Range Rover, but Delaroche thought it was best to use only hiking boots, since the ground lay beneath only a few inches of hard frozen snow. Astrid struggled up and down the hillsides and through the dense trees. She was slightly awkward and ungainly in the best of circumstances. Her long body was thoroughly unsuited to the rigors of winter mountain hiking. Once she slipped down a hillside and came to rest flat on her back with her legs propped against a tree. Delaroche was not certain exactly when they left Canada and entered the United States. There was no border demarcation, no fence, no visible electronic surveillance of any kind. His employers had selected the spot well. Delaroche remembered a night a long time ago, when as a young boy he had crossed into the West from Czechoslovakia to Austria, accompanied by 2 KGB agents. He remembered the warm night, arc lights and razor wire, the thick scent of manure in the air. He remembered raising his gun and shooting his escorts. Even now, walking through the freezing Vermont morning, he closed his eyes at the thought of it, his first assassinations. He had been acting on orders from Vladimir. To describe Vladimir as his case officer would be an understatement. Vladimir was his world. Vladimir was everything to Delaroche, his teacher, his priest, his tormentor, his father. He taught him to read and to write. He taught him language and history. He taught him tradecraft and killing. When it was time to go to the West, Vladimir handed Delaroche to Arbatov, the way a parent entrusts a child to a relative. Vladimir's last order was to kill the escorts. The act instilled something very important in Delaroche. He would never trust anyone, especially someone from his own service. When he was older, he realized that was exactly what Vladimir had intended. The terrain softened as they came down from the ridge. Delaroche, using the map and a compass, guided them to the outskirts of a village called Highgate Springs, 2 miles south of the border. The second Range Rover was waiting for them, parked in a stand of pine bordering a snow-covered cornfield. Delaroche placed the gear in the back, and they climbed inside. This time, the engine started on the first try. Delaroche drove carefully along the icy 2-lane road. Astrid, exhausted from the hike, immediately fell into a deep, dreamless sleep. 40 minutes later, Delaroche came to Interstate 89 and headed south. Chapter 39, Washington, D.C. Why would Adrian lie to you about the existence of October? Elizabeth's question sounded strange to Michael. It was like a child asking about sex for the first time. Their new openness was alien to him, and he felt awkward discussing agency matters candidly with his wife. Still, he did enjoy it. Elizabeth, with her lawyer's intellect and secretive nature, would have made a good intelligence officer if she had not chosen the law. Our intelligence services run on the concept of need to know. The argument could be made that I had no need to know about October's existence, and therefore I was never told of it.
But Michael, he murdered Sarah in front of your eyes. If anyone should be allowed to see what the agency had on him, it's you.
Good point. But information is kept from intelligence officers all the time, for all kinds of different reasons.
The Soviet Union has been dead and buried for ages. Why would his file be so restricted?
We give up our dead slowly in the intelligence community, Elizabeth. There's nothing an intelligence service likes more than a good pile of useless secrets.
Maybe someone wanted it restricted.
I've considered that possibility. Michael stopped in front of the Washington Post building on 15th Street. Tom Logan, Susanna Dayton's editor, had asked to meet with Elizabeth. Michael had planned to wait in the car, but now said, "Mind if I tag along?"
"Not at all. But we have to hurry. We're late."
"Where are you supposed to meet him?"
"In his office. Why?"
"I'm just not crazy about enclosed places, that's all."
"Michael, this isn't East Berlin. Cut it out."
But Michael had already snatched the cell phone from its cradle. "What's his extension?"
5684.
The telephone rang, and Logan's secretary answered. "This is Michael Osborne. May I speak to Mr. Logan, please?"
Logan came on the line and said,
"Hello, Mike.
Elizabeth and I are downstairs. Mind if we change the venue?"
"Of course not.
We're on 15th Street, Silver Jaguar.
I'll be down in 5 minutes."
Michael snapped the handset back into place.
Elizabeth said, "What's the problem?"
"You know that feeling you get when someone's looking at you?"
"Sure."
"I have it right now. I can't find him, but I know he's out there." Michael stared into the rearview mirror for a moment.
"I have good instincts," he said distantly. "And I always trust my instincts."
5 minutes later, Logan walked out the front door of the Post building. Logan was tall and bald, and the wind was playing havoc with his fringe of overgrown graying hair. He wore no overcoat, just a crimson scarf wrapped around his thin neck, and his hands were jammed in the pockets of wrinkled gray flannels. Osborne reached back and threw open the rear door. Logan climbed in and said, "God, I love the weather in this town. 70 degrees yesterday and 40 today." Michael pressed down hard on the accelerator, and the Jaguar leaped from the curb into the heavy traffic of downtown Washington. Logan buckled his seatbelt and clutched the armrest.
"What do you do for a living, Mike?"
"I sell computer equipment to large clients overseas."
"Ah, sounds interesting."
Michael turned left on M Street and sped west across downtown. He turned right on New Hampshire, raced around DuPont Circle, and accelerated west along Massachusetts Avenue. He expertly weaved in and out of traffic and spent more time looking in his rearview mirror than at the road ahead of him. Logan had by now nearly torn the armrest from the rear door.
"I didn't catch the name of the company you work for, Mike."
"That's because I didn't tell you. And I prefer Michael, Tom." Elizabeth turned around and took a long look over her shoulder.
"Anything?" she asked.
"If anyone was there, they're gone now." He slowed down and fell into a pace with the rest of the traffic. Logan let go of the armrest and relaxed.
"Computer salesman, my ass," he said.
Henry Rodriguez had been assigned to watch Elizabeth Osborne that day, but he broke off the chase along M Street. Michael Osborne, a former field officer, was trained to recognize sophisticated physical surveillance. One person, crudely disguised as a Chinese food deliveryman, could be spotted in a matter of minutes. He pulled to the curb and telephoned Mark Callahan at the command post in Colorama.
"He was definitely trying to shake a tail," Rodriguez said. "If I tried to hang with him, he would have made me."
"Good call. Go back to Georgetown. Wait for them to show." Callahan walked into the library to break the news to Mitchell Elliott. Logan must need help, Elliott said. Why else would he be meeting with her now? She's in a position to do serious damage. Perhaps we should tighten things up a bit.
I agree, Elliott said. I think it's time Henry went back to work.
He's not going to like being a janitor again. He feels we're discriminating against him because of his Hispanic heritage. If he doesn't like it, let him file a complaint with the EEOC. I pay him well to do what he's told.
Callahan smiled.
Yes, sir, Mr. Elliott. Michael found a parking spot on East Capitol Street. He dug an old windbreaker from the trunk for Tom Logan, and they walked in Lincoln Park beneath cold, slate-gray skies. Logan said, "How much of Susanna's original material did you read?"
"Enough to get the picture," Elizabeth said.
"Let me refresh your memory," Logan said. "In the early 80s, Beckwith wanted out of politics. More specifically, Anne Beckwith wanted out of politics. She wanted her husband back in the private sector, where he could earn some serious money before he was too old. Both of them had a little family money, but not much. Anne likes nice things. She wanted more than what they could get on a government paycheck. He'd done 2 terms in the Senate, and she told him it was politics or her. A pair of joggers approached them from behind, each with a dog straining at the end of a leash. Logan, like a good field man, waited for them to pass out of earshot before resuming. Beckwith is a lot of things, but he's totally devoted to Anne, and the last thing he wanted was to lose her. But he also enjoyed politics and wasn't particularly thrilled about practicing law again. He called his advisors and money boys together in San Francisco one night and broke the news. Needless to say, Mitchell Elliott was apoplectic. He'd invested a lot of time and money in Beckwith over the years, and he didn't want that investment to go to waste. He telephoned Anne the next morning and asked to meet privately with her. That night over dinner, Anne took it all back and encouraged Beckwith to run for governor. He won, of course, and the rest, as they say, is history. Michael said, "What happened in that meeting between Anne Beckwith and Mitchell Elliott?" Elliott assured Anne that if her husband remained in politics, they both would be well cared for financially. The first stage was simple stuff, and in the overall scheme of things, it was chump change. Elliott got his powerful friends in the business community to place Anne on more than 12 boards of directors. She earned money as a consultant, even though she had almost no business experience. She also invested very wisely, with help from Elliott, we suspect, and she made a killing in the financial markets. Within 3 years, Anne had a substantial war chest, a few $1,000,000. She took almost all of that money and bought several 100 acres of what was then worthless desert south of San Diego. 2 years later, a developer announced plans to build a new community of condominiums, single-family homes, and a strip mall right on Anne's land. Suddenly, her worthless land was worth a great deal of money.
Mitchell Elliott was behind it all? Elizabeth asked.
We think so, but we can't prove it, and therefore we can't print it. Elliott needed help to devise all these schemes. He had big plans for Beckwith, and he didn't want him tarnished by scandal. He needed someone who understood Washington, and, more importantly, understood how to circumvent campaign finance laws. He turned to a high-powered Washington lawyer.
Samuel Braxton, Elizabeth said.
That's right, Logan said. And finally, after years of waiting, Elliott's investment paid off big this year. The National Missile Defense was dead in the water. But 24 hours after Flight 002 went down, Elliott was inside the White House for a meeting with Beckwith. Susanna saw it. She also saw Elliott and Vandenberg together later that same night. The next evening, Beckwith goes before the nation, announces strikes against the Sword of Gaza, and proposes building a national missile defense. Capitol Hill is suddenly all for missile defense, Andrew Sterling is pinned to the wall because he's on record against it. Beckwith pulls out the election, and Elliot's Electron Defense System is in line to earn several billion dollars.
So why haven't you gone with Susanna's story? Michael asked.
Like I told your wife before, on a story like this, we go over every fact, every quote, every piece of information with the reporter before publication. In this case, the reporter is dead. And we had to start over, using her original copy as a roadmap. We've got most of it, but we're missing a very important piece of the puzzle. Somehow, Susanna got hold of original financial and real estate documents. We suspect she had a source inside Braxton, Allworth, and Kettleman who gave her the documents. We've been through Susanna's files, and we can't find them. We've tried to find our own source inside the firm, but we haven't been successful. Logan shivered and tied his scarf more tightly around his neck. Elizabeth, obviously you can answer this question any way you see fit, but I have to ask it. Were you the source for those documents?
No, Elizabeth said quickly. Susanna asked me, and I told her I wouldn't do it. I told her it was unethical, and if it ever became known that I leaked the documents, my career would be destroyed.
Logan hesitated a moment, then said, Will you do it now?
No, I won't.
Elizabeth, Samuel Braxton is a dishonest lawyer and criminal who's about to be rewarded by being made Secretary of State. I don't know about you, but that pisses me off. And as a journalist, I'd like to do something about it. But I can't, not without your help. Now, if you're concerned about whether you'll be protected, I assure you we will do nothing that will endanger you in any way. You can trust me.
Tom, I've lived in Washington most of my life, and there's one thing I've learned. You can't trust anyone in this town.
Logan stopped walking and turned to face Michael.
You don't work for a computer company that sells to overseas buyers. You work in the counterterrorism center at the Central Intelligence Agency.
You were the hero in that attack at Heathrow Airport, and you were involved in the bombing on that Channel ferry. I know you may find this hard to believe, Michael, but even people in your outfit like to talk to reporters. We didn't publish the information because we didn't want to place you in any danger.
Logan turned and looked at Elizabeth. I won't do anything that will get you hurt. You can trust me, Elizabeth.
Chapter 40. Bethesda, Maryland. Delaroche became nervous for the first time when he left Interstate 95 and headed onto the Capitol Beltway. He had driven some of the most demanding roads of Europe, winding highways in France and Italy, deadly mountain roads in the Alps and the Pyrenees. But nothing had prepared him for the madness of the Washington evening rush hour. The trip from Vermont had gone smoothly. The weather had been good, except for a brief snowstorm in upstate New York, and a patch of freezing drizzle along the New Jersey Turnpike. The temperatures warmed the farther south they traveled, and the rain had ended at Philadelphia. Now it was the other drivers Delaroche feared most. Cars were roaring by him at 85 miles per hour, 30 miles above the speed limit, and the truck behind him was riding 6 feet from his bumper. Delaroche thought how easy it would be to have a collision under circumstances like these. The results would be disastrous. Because he was a foreigner, the police would want to see his passport. If the officer was alert and knew anything about passports, he would notice that Delaroche's bore no entrance visa. He would probably be taken into custody and questioned by immigration authorities and the FBI. His identity would crumble and he would be arrested, all because of some nut trying to get home from work. The cars in front of him braked suddenly. The traffic came to a standstill. Delaroche found an all-news station on the radio and listened to the traffic update. Somewhere ahead of him, a tractor-trailer rig had overturned. Traffic was snarled for miles. Delaroche thought of his home in Guélé. He thought of the sea smashing against the rocks
and of pedaling his Italian racing bike along the quiet back roads of the Finisterre. He must have been daydreaming, because the man in the car behind him blared his horn and waved his arms frantically. The driver changed lanes, pulled alongside de la Roche, and made a vulgar gesture with his hand.
"Please, Jean-Paul," Astrid said, "let me get my gun from the back and shoot him."
30 minutes later, they approached the scene of the accident. A Maryland state trooper stood in the roadway, directing traffic around the overturned truck. De la Roche tensed reflexively in the presence of a police officer. The fire trucks and ambulances disappeared behind them, and the traffic began moving again. De la Roche exited at Wisconsin Avenue and headed south. He sped through downtown Bethesda, past the exclusive shops of the Maza Galleria, the towering spires of the National Cathedral. Wisconsin Avenue fell away into Georgetown. Shoppers moved quickly through the cold evening air, and the bars and restaurants were beginning to fill. He turned left at M Street, drove a few blocks, and turned into the entrance of the Four Seasons Hotel. De la Roche checked them in, refusing the bellman's offer to help with the bags. He closed the door, and they both fell onto the bed, exhausted from the two long drives and the hike across the border. De la Roche awoke after 2 hours, ordered coffee from room service, and sat down at his laptop computer. While Astrid slept, he opened Michael Osborne's dossier and began planning his death. Chapter 41, Washington, D.C. Elizabeth telephoned Max Lewis at the office late in the afternoon. "How are you feeling?" he said over the rustle of papers. It was after 5 p.m., and he was preparing to leave the office for the day, which is why Elizabeth called then. "I'm fine, but the doctor says I really have to stay off my feet as much as possible during the next week or so. Actually, that's why I'm calling. I was wondering if you could bring me some papers on your way home tonight." "No problem. What do you need?" "The McGregor case file. It's on my desk." "Actually, it's back in your file room. I took the liberty of cleaning off your desk today. Honestly, Elizabeth, I don't know how you get any work done in there. I also threw out all your cigarettes." "Don't worry. I've given them up. No more Chardonnay in the bathtub after work, either." "Good girl," he said. "I'll be there in 15 minutes. Need anything else? Want me to pick up your cleaning? Do some shopping for you at Sutton Place? Command me, my queen. Just bring me the McGregor file. I'll reward you with food and wine." "In that case, I'll be there in 5 minutes. I'm flat on my back in bed, so use your key." "Yes, my queen." Max hung up. Michael was on a chair and ottoman at the foot of the bed, listening to the conversation on the cordless phone. He looked at Elizabeth and said, "Perfect." It took Max more than a half hour to fight his way through traffic to Georgetown from the firm's Connecticut Avenue office. He stuck his key in the Osborne's lock, opened the door, and stepped inside the entrance hall. "Elizabeth, it's me," he called. "Hey, Max, come on up. There's cold wine in the fridge. Grab a glass and a corkscrew." He did as he was told and walked up the stairs. He found Elizabeth sprawled on the bed, surrounded by stacks of briefs and legal pads. "My God," he said. "Maybe I should work here instead of downtown." "That might not be such a bad idea." He placed the McGregor files on the bedside table and instinctively began straightening papers and organizing her things. Michael walked into the room. Max said, "Hey, Michael, how are you?" Michael said nothing. Max said, "Something wrong?" Elizabeth touched his arm and said, "Max, we need to talk." "Susanna came to me after you turned her down," Max said. He was sitting in the chair in the bedroom, legs sprawled across the ottoman. Michael had opened the wine, and Max drank half the bottle very fast. The initial shock of the confrontation had worn off, and now he was relaxed and talking freely. "She asked me to help her. I slept on it, and then I agreed to do it." "Max, if you had been caught, they'd have fired you and probably prosecuted you.
Law firms can't tolerate theft in violation of attorney-client privilege. It doesn't make clients feel good, and it makes it damned hard to attract new ones. I was willing to take the risk. When you're in my position, Elizabeth, you tend not to take a real long view of things. I don't want to be judgmental, Max, but you should have come to me first, Elizabeth said. I hired you. You worked for me. The firm would have fallen on me like a ton of bricks. And what would you have said? I would have told you not to do it. That's why I didn't come to you. Why, Max? Why go after Braxton like that? Max looked at Elizabeth as though he found the question offensive. Why Braxton? Because he's a dirty, crooked asshole who's about to become Secretary of State. I'm surprised you even have to ask the question. I've heard the way he talks to you in the partners' meetings, and I've heard the way he talks about you when you're not around. He hesitated a moment, looked at Michael, and said, Can I bum one of those from you? Michael handed him the pack and the lighter. Max smoked for a moment and drank more of the wine. It's personal, too, he said finally. Someone told Braxton I was HIV positive. He was working behind your back to get me fired as one of the last acts before leaving the firm. I wanted to make his final week so fucked up he wouldn't have time to deal with me. And Susanna gave me the opportunity to do it. Michael said, How did you get the documents? I stole one of the keys to his file room and copied it. That night I went into the office on the pretense that I had some work to do. I went into the file room, took the documents, and headed over to Susanna's place. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.